Welcome to the Great Detectives of Old Time Radio. From Boise, Idaho, this is your host, Adam Graham. If you have a comment, email it to me. Box13@greatdetectives.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Detectives and become one of our friends on Facebook. Facebook.com/Radio Detectives. Today's episode is brought to you by the financial support of our listeners. Thank you so much for your support. Coming up later in the program, we will wrap up the Chesapeake fraud matter. But now it's time for part two of Call for a Columnist. And when we last left Johnny Lane, he was waking up to a dangerous-looking visitor.
Carter Brown Mysteries. Adventures in excitement and suspense, based on the best-selling novels by the slick storytelling sensation, Carter Brown.
You'd think people would have a little more respect for my position, not to say my feelings. After all, 4 million readers turn regularly every day to my column, to the headline, Dynamite with Johnny Lane. I'm somebody in this town. And what happens? Just because I print a hint in my column about a mobster's imminent demise, a hint thrown my way by an anonymous female phone call, I'm suddenly everybody's favorite focus of attention. The wrong kind of attention. Like the guy at my penthouse door shoving a gun into my stomach and telling me to get inside.
That's bitter, Mr. Lane. Now we can get down to business.
Now look, I got no business with anyone like you. I'm just a newspaper columnist.
You printed that item about Albert Ferraro's murder, didn't you? Before it happened.
Yeah, but look, O'Byrne, the chief of police, and the captain of his stanger, they wanted to know about it too. But I didn't tell them anything, so you and your friends don't need to be nervous.
No, but you do. You're gonna need protection, friend. I just proved it.
What?
You're a sitting duck, Mr. Lane. I could have blown your head off, and who was to stop me?
Who are you?
My card.
What? Leonard's Private Detective Missing Persons Trace Bodyguard Supply.
And that's just what you need, a bodyguard. Now, I can supply one. Our rates are $35 a day in expenses. That's not too much to save your life, is it, Mr. Lane?
No, I guess not, but...
No buts, Mr. Lane. Now, suppose I'd been one of these criminals you've been ridiculing in your column. You'd have been dead by now.
Okay, you sold me.
Oh, fine, now. Got one of our standard agreements here. If you will sign it, I'll spend the night on your sofa, and in the morning I'll assign a regular bodyguard to you.
Who will that be?
Oh, Tony Spencer, my best operative.
Okay. I don't know that I approve of your method, Mr. Arch, but you got a deal. The comforting reassurance of the private eye's presence in the sofa in the other room gave me 8 hours solid slumber. But when I yawned the morning in, I nearly dislocated my jaw halfway through the yawn. The sofa was empty. Then I remembered. Arch must have gone out to arrange about Tony Spencer, my permanent bodyguard. And Police Chief O'Byrne's threats of the night before disappeared in the thought of constant protection from some nice, hefty ex-heavyweight. The percolator was bubbling and soft music from the radio was cheering the morning when the buzzer went. I bounded to greet my bodyguard.
Mr. Lane?
Sure. What can I do for you?
It's what I can do for you, Mr. Lane. I presume it's all right for me to come in. You have a nice place here, Mr. Lane. I think I'm going to like it.
You do?
I certainly do.
Well, that's fine, just fine. Beautiful blonde is just what I need in my life. Honey, come to Papa.
Hey! Hey, what hit me? A blockbuster?
I don't know why it is, but I have this trouble with every assignment.
Huh?
It's always the same. Men just can't get used to the idea of a female bodyguard.
You mean you're Tony Spencer?
That's right. And there's no need to look so surprised. There are female lawyers, doctors, dentists. Why not a female private detective?
But I can't go around with a lady bodyguard. I've been the laughingstock of the town. Now, I'm sorry, but you'd better go back to the agency. I'll pay for the day's hire, of course.
It'll cost you more than that. Didn't you read the penalty clause in the agreement?
I didn't read it. I just signed it.
Your agreement calls for a bodyguard for a minimum of 2 weeks. If you break the contract, the full premium is due immediately, plus compensation of $500.
That's blackmail.
That's business. Well, do I stay?
Who am I to argue with a beautiful girl? Especially when she's a jiu-jitsu expert.
Well, there's certainly one thing about working for you, Mr. Lane. A girl gets taken to the best places.
Oh, I'm here every night. Jewel and I have an understanding. You know, I can't get over...
What?
That dress.
Why is something showing?
Nothing that shouldn't be.
Johnny! Oh, you remembered. Oh, I didn't realize you had company.
Simone, sit down. This is Tony Spencer. Simone. She's half the Adagio team in the floor show. Simon and Simone.
Yes, I've heard about you. Especially about that intriguing finish to your act where you spin off the stage. Tell me, do you have to take your meals off the mantelpiece afterwards?
You must wait and see. Unfortunately, not tonight. Simon is ill, so we do not perform tonight.
What a pity. I'm just dying from curiosity.
Just so long as it's from Sophie.
Mr. Lane, will you excuse me? I want a part of my nose. It's obviously not wanted here.
I admire your taste, Johnny. I must even confess to a minute touch of jealousy.
Jealousy? Oh, you flatter me, Simone.
I thought we had a mutual interest in each other. I was even hoping that as I had a night off tonight...
Oh, you don't have to worry about Tony. She's only a buddy.
Well, that isn't exactly a nice way to describe a girl.
I mean, she's only a friend. Simone, how about we fade quietly away while the opportunity's ripe, huh?
Indeed, your girlfriend.
Oh, she won't care. Come on, let's get while the getting's good.
All right, Johnny. And I know just the place.
Yeah? Where?
My apartment.
This is what you call really living. Beautiful girl, cozy apartment.
Oh, it's just a place to sleep. You know, you fascinate me, Johnny.
I do?
Mm-hmm. What does it feel like to be a power in the land? To know that what you write today is read by 4 million people the following day?
Oh, feels just like any other job where you can make $100,000 a year.
Hey, Johnny, tell me about Mr. Beak who runs the vice rackets. I'm dying to know who he really is.
Well, so am I, honey.
Oh, come on, Johnny, don't be a sourpuss. I won't breathe a word to anybody.
Sorry, honey. I wish I could tell you, but I can't.
Oh, Johnny. Blast. I don't know who this is, but I don't want them, whoever they are.
She moved out into the hall, and I got a lot of pleasure out of following that swing and sway walk. In a couple of minutes, she came back with 2 men behind her. The first one had a face like a horse in a suit with more padding than the average woman's magazine serial. The second had white hair and blue eyes covered by black, heavy-rimmed spectacles.
Johnny!
Well, company. Introduce me to your friend, Simone.
I can't. I don't know them.
What do they want?
I don't know.
Why don't you ask them?
Because the one with the glasses has a gun in my back, and he told me to shut up if I wanted to stay alive.
Oh.
Okay, that's enough. We're in a hurry. Come on, let's go.
Johnny, do something.
Well, it's a shame to break up a pleasant evening. These gentlemen are so anxious for your company, Simone.
We don't want the dame. We want you, Buster.
Me?
Yeah. So grab your hat and get moving.
I had to put up a struggle, but I was outnumbered. There were 4 of them. 2 men and 2 guns. I was bundled out of the apartment into a car.
About an hour later, after more twists and turns than a roller coaster with hiccups, we pulled up outside a dilapidated shack off the main highway. Two hoods shoved me inside. By a roaring log fire stood a ravishing redhead. When she saw me, she smiled. When I saw her, I blinked and did a double take.
Hello, Johnny.
Hey, weren't you a blonde last time I saw you?
Could be. I really forget.
Oh, the world suddenly gets to be a small place. I remember. You're a piece of dirt I wouldn't use in my column.
You use such nice language, Johnny.
Senator Roland's girlfriend.
Ex. That's important, Johnny. Ex-girlfriend.
Thelma, as I live and breathe.
Which you will for a long time, I hope. Ah, aren't you going to say thank you? I gave you some good stuff for your column, didn't I?
The best. Wild mystery, the anonymous phone calls, and this kidnapping. If you'd called me, I'd have come.
Oh, we'd have preferred it this way, Johnny. Maybe we got a peculiar sense of humor.
Okay, so I'm laughing and now the gag's over. Can I go home now?
Sorry, Johnny, the gag isn't over. Not yet. You're staying right here for 2 or 3 days.
What for?
Well, we thought the peace and quiet would give you a chance to write your column without any interruptions.
Now, don't be crazy. How can I write my column here? I can't get in touch with any of my contacts. I'll be isolated.
Well, you don't have to worry about that, Johnny. You see, we've written your column for you.
What?
That's right. To cover 2 issues and asking a few interesting questions, like, do people know that the learned Senator Roland made his money out of slot machines in the first place, setting up the wires for bookies in the second place, and dope and call girl rackets in the third place? Also, that Albert Ferraro was bumped off not because he was going to sing to the Senator's investigation committee, but because he was trying a double cross. And finally, asking whose influence got Police Chief O'Byrne his job.
Holy cow.
And all you've got to do is copy the stuff out in your style and handwriting so we can deliver it to the news.
If you think I'm sending that sort of stuff to my paper, you're crazy.
If you think you're not, you're as good as dead.
Yeah, but insinuations like that about Roland and O'Byrne, I'll be shot.
You'll be shot either way. So what have you got to lose?
I'm always a guy who'll see reason, especially when there's a gun pointing at my midriff. Thelma stood over me while I batted out the column on a ramshackle typewriter. I presume she just wanted to check on my spelling. And she and the white-haired guy, they called him the professor, grabbed the car and headed for town, leaving me in the tender care of the horse-faced character, whom I, logically enough, called Horseface.
You just keep in line, pal, and you and me'll get along but fine.
Now, look, look, fella, what's the sense in keeping me here? I did what Thelma wanted, didn't I? You might as well let me go now, huh?
Oh, no, we ain't that dumb. First thing you do when you get back to town is cancel them columns. Oh, no, pal, you stay right here. Hey, what's that?
Sounds like visitors at the front door.
I ain't expecting nobody. I'll go see. And you keep your trap shut, pal.
Oh, ah. What the... Hey, who is it? Hey, Horseface.
Wow, that's a fine thing to call a girl.
Tell me.
You rat, running out on me like that. Don't be surprised if Mr. Arch invokes Clause 14 of the contract.
Clause 14?
Non-cooperation. Non-cooperation of a client doubles the fees payable to the agency.
Look, never mind the fees. How did you get here?
I'm a private detective, remember?
Yeah, but Horseface, the guy who opened the door.
It came off and hit him. Now, come on, we're getting out of here. Mr. Arch is outside in the car. We've got everything arranged.
Boy, you sure work fast.
We've got a hideout all arranged where you can lie low for a couple of days.
Lie low? What are you talking about? I got to get back to town and stop from publishing my column.
I don't know anything about your column. I've got my orders for Mr. Arch. You've got to hide out for a few days.
I am doing nothing of the sort. I am not moving from here except to go back to town.
Oh, well, if you feel like that. Sorry, Mr. Lane, but orders are orders.
Welcome back. One is tempted to pun that the bodyguard was a knockout in more ways than one. Well, next week, we'll find out if Johnny Lane is able to salvage his journalistic reputation, such as it is, and a very interesting private detective contract. We'll see how this all plays out next week. But now, we turn to that man with the action-packed expense account, yours truly, Johnny Dollar, as we wrap up the Chesapeake fraud matter.
From Hollywood, it's time now for Bob Bailey as...
Johnny Dollar.
This is the operator. Ready with your call to Mr. Pat Kelleher in Baltimore. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello, Pat.
I got your wire. What's all this? What happened?
We're still trying to find out. The man calling himself Frank Bowers was killed an hour ago. George Hanley, one of the operatives I had watching him, was killed, too. We've got a vague description of the killer.
Are you all right?
Yeah, but I'm going to be tied up with the police here.
Well, you need money for bail or anything like that, just draw a draft on the company. I'll confirm it.
Thanks, Pat.
Too bad about your friend.
Yeah, he was a good guy. I want to find out who killed him.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Universal Adjustment Bureau, Baltimore, Maryland. The following is an accounting of expenditures during my investigation of the Chesapeake fraud matter. Expense account continued. Item 13, a quarter for some aspirin. It turned out to be a long night. Several homicide officers arrived at the double murder scene within a matter of minutes and got right down to the business at hand. Frank Bowers had been shot to death. George Hanley had been shot to death. Lieutenant Tom O'Neill was in charge, a big blonde man who seemed to know what he was about.
Okay, let's see that ID again.
Here you go.
Insurance investigator, hmm?
That's right.
Okay. What was your business here with these two men?
My home office in Baltimore had reason to believe that Frank Bowers was really a man named John Reardon. Reardon was supposed to have died 5 years ago. I was sent out here to investigate it since there had been a $20,000 claim in the matter.
Sure, sure.
I hired George Hanley to help me out. He was keeping an eye on Frank Bowers. I came out earlier tonight to give him a hand and the shooting began.
Any idea who did it?
A big man in a top coat and a hat. I really didn't get a look at him, Lieutenant. I was busy with George Hanley.
Sure. You carry a gun?
Sometimes. I didn't have one tonight.
You tried to chase the killer?
I said I was busy with my friend.
Yeah, that's right, you did. Well, how was your investigation coming along?
Frank Bauer's fingerprints didn't match the samples I had for John Reardon, but it didn't satisfy me. There were a lot of things about him personally I couldn't accept. I harassed him a little last night, and he got pretty excited and slugged me. This was after I found out he'd been trying to call Baltimore.
Who in Baltimore?
I don't know.
Well, tell me about this harassing. You'll make a check with the phone company.
Well, I needled him purposely, trying to scare him into a blunder. I think I was doing pretty good. I'll never know now.
Uh-huh. What else you got to say about your case?
Well, that's about it, Lieutenant.
It is, huh?
Well, that's all I got to say because that's all I know about it.
Next time, be careful with your needling tactics, boy.
I was doing what I thought best on the case.
Sure you were. You were doing swell. You let a friend of yours get shot down in front of your eyes. Not to mention the other guy. You can't give us a description of the killer or a hint at the motive. Now, maybe George Hanley wasn't a friend of yours at that.
Why, you...
Dad, take it easy, kiddo. Take it easy. Remember to blow the bell, and I'm sorry. You've had quite a night. Nobody in your business or mine knows what's behind the door when he kicks it in. I'm just a cop trying to get straightened out, so I push too hard sometimes. We'll get it taken care of. Nobody walks in a man's house and shoots him down without somebody hearing something or seeing something. I mean, somebody besides you. Now, my men will cover every house in the block, in this whole area if we have to. Bound to be somebody somewhere.
The dogged Lieutenant O'Neill turned out to be 100% correct. In fact, he turned out to be 300% correct. For by 11 o'clock the following morning, his men had located three different people who had information about the brutal murders of Frank Bowers and George Hanley. The first was a man named Randall who had lived across the street. He had seen Bowers open his front door and admit the unknown killer. He said he wore glasses. The second was a paper boy who had come to collect while the killer was there. He stated that the killer and Bowers were arguing when he came up to the door. The third witness, a housewife, gave the most important information as to the man's description.
He was a good deal taller than Mr. Bowers.
How much taller?
3-4 inches at least. I saw him standing in the doorway from here. He had on a brown tweed top coat. My husband has one just like it.
How old would you say he was?
45.
Have you ever seen him before?
No.
Would you know him if you saw him again?
Yes, anywhere.
You got that good look at him, huh?
Yes, the porch light was on.
Here's something, Dollar.
Lieutenant O'Neill had issued an all-points bulletin based on the combined descriptions given by the witnesses. In the meantime, his men had checked the local cab companies and found out that one of the drivers had carried a fare to Frank Bauer's home at 8 o'clock in the evening. The cab driver verified the housewife's description of the suspect and added the important information that he'd picked up the man at the airport. When that was checked, it was found the man had come in on a plane from the east at 5:45 in the afternoon. He had used the name Orrin Williams. Expense account item 14, $8.95. Another long-distance phone call to Baltimore and Pat Kelleher.
Well, I'll be darned. Do you have to stay there, John?
Of course I have to stay here. I'm a material witness. Not to mention the fact that a pal of mine was shot down.
Don't get on your high horse, John. It was just a question. Have any idea what it was all about?
Well, at the moment, I'm just sure a guy named Orrin Williams flew in, shot up two people, and beat it. If we had Williams, I'd give you the whole thing on a silver platter.
You're awfully touchy.
Well, this thing has gotten out of hand.
Well, I won't press you on it anymore, John. You do what you think is best. As far as the company's concerned, it's really not our business anymore, is it?
It's our business until it's cleared up.
Well, I mean Bowers. He wasn't John Reardon.
Dollar?
Hold it, Pat. Yeah?
Answer from Washington on your wire.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Here.
Let me see. Pat.
Yeah?
It is our business after all.
Huh?
The lieutenant here sent a hurry-up request to Washington on some of Bauer's fingerprints I mailed a couple of days ago. They check out.
I don't get it.
Bowers was John Reardon.
Oh. Well, where'd you get the samples of Reardon's prints that didn't check out?
From Hugh Bryan, Reardon's attorney.
Well, I better call him.
Don't you dare. Don't open your mouth. I'll handle it when I get there.
Tell me about this fella, Hugh Bryan. According to the phone company, that's the man Bowers was trying to call in Baltimore.
I told him all I knew, and Lieutenant O'Neill listened thoughtfully. It became apparent from that point on, since Bauer's true identity had been established through Army records, that the bulk of the case could be concluded not in Denver, but in Baltimore. Expense account item 16, $216, plane fare and incidentals, Denver to Baltimore. I arrived at 10:15 in the evening, checked with the Baltimore police, who had been informed of the case by Tom O'Neill in Denver. At his request, they'd taken no action as yet. From the police station, I went directly to Hugh Bryan's residence. The house was English, conservative, and expensive. The fire in the living room looked cheerful when the door opened. Elizabeth Reardon did not look so cheerful.
Hello, Johnny.
Hello, Mrs. Reardon. Didn't expect to find you here.
No, I suppose not. I never expected to see you again.
Elizabeth, I have something to tell you.
Don't tell me now, Johnny.
It's about your husband.
All right.
I want to tell Mr. Bryan, too.
He's upstairs in his study.
Oh, wait. Look, I've done what I thought best about all this, and I'm trying to do what's best now.
It doesn't make any difference, Johnny. I'm a married woman again.
Huh?
Yes. Hugh and I were married this morning. Excuse me.
I walked in and watched John Reardon's widow, alias Frank Bauer's widow, now Hugh Bryan's bride, disappear up a column stairway. The news that she had married Hugh Bryan cleared up some of the small doubts in my mind. When Bryan came back down the stairs with her, he looked anything but the happy bridegroom.
Hello, Dollar. You're a late caller.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Congratulations.
Thank you. How did you come out in Denver? Everything okay?
No, everything's not okay.
Well, what's the matter?
Do I have to tell you?
I'll run along upstairs, Hugh. It's getting terribly late.
All right, dear.
Good night, Mr. Dollar.
Good night, Mrs. Bryan. There'll be some men out to see you pretty soon, Bryan. Policemen.
Oh. Liz.
Yes, dear?
I think you'll be interested in what Mr. Dollar has to say.
What? Well, I don't understand, Hugh.
I wasn't in Philadelphia yesterday, Liz. I was in Denver, Colorado.
What?
I flew there to see John. He's been alive and living there all this time.
Hugh.
I'm sorry. This is only for her benefit, Dollar. I'll tell it just once. When it gets into court, it'll be different.
How did it happen, Bryan? John Reardon didn't die in that boat.
No. He was picked up in the bay by a fishing boat on his way to Florida. They didn't have a radio on the fishing boat. The first port they came to was Charleston. John phoned me from there and told me all about it. Now, this was 10 days after we all thought he was dead. That part was all accident.
Sure.
The rest of it was a little different. Liz, it was his idea. You've got to believe that.
What was his idea?
Not showing up ever again. Letting everyone think he was really dead. Making you a widow.
I don't believe it.
He hated his life here. Yes, everything about it. He was in debt, right up to his ears. Of course, there was your money, but I flew down to Charleston to talk to him. He was like a crazy man, kept saying there was a way out. I didn't know what he meant at first. Then he came right out and said it was his chance to get away from all the things he hated. He knew how I felt about you then, how I feel about you now. He said I could have you for a price.
What was the price? Those checks he got every week from a New York bonding concern?
Yes.
What did they come to?
$25,000 a year, regular weekly payments. I could afford it. I could afford anything for you, Liz.
Did he come right out and tell you he hated me?
He just said he wanted to get away from everything. It went that way for 5 years. I believe I asked you to marry me every 6 months.
Yes.
But that didn't work out either. And then, one day, along came Johnny Dollar. How does it feel to be so efficient, Mr. Dollar?
We don't have to go into that, do we?
No.
I'll admit you did everything to throw me off. And it threw me off. Especially the fingerprints you provided.
Didn't John Reardon insist his name was Frank Bowers and do everything he could to make you believe that was true?
He did too much to make me think it was true.
Where is he now? Where's John?
He's dead, Mrs. Bryan.
Oh.
Truly dead now. He was shot to death last night by Mr. Bryan. Mr. Bryan also shot a friend of mine, didn't you, Bryan?
Yes. John got scared, called me, said he was going to tell everything to Dollar, blow the whole thing.
Hugh.
All I wanted out of this was you, Liz. He didn't want you. I did. Last week you decided to marry me. It took you 5 years to do that. And it took him one afternoon to decide he was going to come back to you.
The proof that John Reardon's widow is guilty or not guilty of a fraudulent insurance claim is a matter for Eastern Fidelity to decide. The matter of Hugh Bryan and two murders is a matter for the courts. Expense account item 17, same as item 1, expenses from Baltimore to Hartford. Item 18, $89 even, car rentals, miscellaneous, etc. Expense account total, $1,124.98. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Remember, please, there'll be a new exciting story on Johnny Dollar beginning next Monday.
Next week, a quiet, sleepy little town in Mexico and a beautiful senorita that... Well, things didn't stay quiet and sleepy for long. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. Written by John Dawson, it is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone. Heard in this week's cast were Gene Bates, D.J. Thompson, Hi Everback, Will Wright, John Daner, Tony Barrett, Paul Dubov, and Forrest Lewis. Be sure to join us on Monday night, same time and station, for another exciting story of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
Welcome back. This script was based on the Walter Patterson matter. It was actually one of the very first John Lunn episodes of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, which was broadcast back on December 26th of 1952. We played it for you on November 4th of 2011. There are still some issues with the plot, maybe a little over-melodramatic, but we had a pretty good investigation along the way. I also think we heard Paul Dubov, who, of course, is the current Frank Race. It doesn't say which part he played, but I think he played Johnny's friend who died in the course of the investigation. All right, well, listener comments and feedback. And we begin with Timothy, who writes in, as always, keep up the terrific work. I have a couple comments about the new five-part Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. First, I tend to agree with earlier comments that Bob Bailey isn't really any better than earlier Johnny Dollar actors. In fact, if I were to rank them, Edmund O'Brien and John Lunn would come in first and second for me. It is possible that the extra time available in the five-part episodes allowed for more character development, and therefore folks would better understand the character. If John Lunn or another actor had been in the five-parters, he might have been more well-liked. Well, there's something to what you're saying. I wouldn't agree with it in total, but I will say that oftentimes we associate the Johnny Dollar programs with the actor who played the lead. These are the Bob Bailey Johnny Dollar episodes. In reality, they're also the Jack Johnstone episodes. And most of them, not all, but a great deal of these best of these 1950s to 1960s Johnny Dollars were Virginia Gregg episodes where she, particularly in these five-parters, showed a great deal of vocal dexterity. She wasn't in this week's show, but she is in next week. She'll be back, and then a couple of weeks after that, she'll be back again. And she had a great deal of availability with the coming of television. Her radio schedule a little less crowded. And let's not forget the music. That was also a key part of it. But that said, it was not just a slam dunk to make 50-minute programs work. As I mentioned before, CBS had tried several shows in this for 15 minutes, and it really hadn't worked out, hadn't held the audience's attention, because you needed to draw people in, give them something to tune in to night after night, and really get some solid ratings to keep this up. Mr. and Mrs. North couldn't do it. Mr. Keen Tracer of Lost Persons couldn't do it. And Gerald Moore as Johnny Dollar and Jack Moyles as Rocky Fortune couldn't make it past the audition stage in the mid-50s to get this 15-minute-a-night slot on CBS. So I wouldn't say it would be a slam dunk for them to be popular or even to make it. And if you recall, John Lunn actually did audition for a 15-minute program before they ended up opting to do the half-hour show. Plus, Bailey's popularity outlasted the 15-minute format, which only went for a year. And then he had 4 years of playing Johnny Dollar in 30-minute episodes. But I do think O'Brien and certainly Lund are underrated, so I was glad to bring them to you. He goes on to say, secondly, I tend to prefer listening to the whole story at once or as close as possible. I have a 30-minute or so commute into work, which makes it ideal for listening to great detectives. I've decided to save the Johnny Dollar episode parts to listen to on Monday, part 1 and 2, going to work, and 3 and 4, returning home, and Tuesday, part 5. I'd appreciate it if you would take the fifth part to be first in the podcast, so I could hear the conclusion of Johnny Dollar before going to another show. This would also allow folks not to listen to the other show if they weren't interested in it. Thanks again for all your excellent work. Well, I appreciate the viewpoint, and I'll listen to listeners on that. The reason I've kind of opted to do it this way is I don't really want any part of the show to be anticlimax. And because on Friday we're going to be wrapping up a Johnny Dollar program, starting a new episode of another series, or in this case, we've got the middle part of another series, just isn't going to work well. Plus, I tend to like to talk right after the Johnny Dollar episodes completed and offer my thoughts on the week's past story. And then to, you know, after lengthy closing commentary, or, you know, in this case, responding to listener comments regarding Johnny Dollar, it just wouldn't flow as well. But, you know, if listeners want it, I am, you know, willing to consider different ways. And there are a few weeks where I will give it a try, at least, with having the Johnny Dollar first. But thanks again. As always, Tim always sends along some great comments and truly appreciate it. And gives me a chance to exercise both my mind and my voice, and appreciate his comments and support. We also have a comment over on Facebook. Alana asks, where did you get your intro music? Is it from a show, or is it an original composition? It is actually a part of the end music from Pat Novak for Hire, which was one of the first shows we did on the program. And I just love the end music. I think it was actually something from the Armed Forces radio service. So, yeah, that was the source. And thanks so much for the question. And I have a new review of the iPhone app over in the iTunes store. Lindsay T.S. Writes, first rate all the way. So glad I found this app. Thanks. Well, thank you so much, Lindsay. And that will actually wrap up today's episode. We will be back tomorrow with the lineup, and then join us back here on Monday. We'll start it all over again with another great episode of yours truly, Johnny Dollar. And join us back here on Friday for part 3 of Call for a Columnist. In the meanwhile, send your comments to Box 13 at GreatDetectives.net. Follow us on Twitter, Radio Detectives, and become one of our friends on Facebook, facebook.com/Radio Detectives. From Boise, Idaho, this is your host, Adam Graham, signing off.